Ayatollah Khamenei says the main enemy confronting Iran is the global arrogance rather than the ill-informed individuals or hired agents stirring up riots. Turkey's president vows to establish a so-called safe zone in northern Syria amid intensified attacks on Kurdish militants there. Also in the headlines, Ukraine's president says Russian missile strikes have left millions of households without power. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Husseini Khamenei, has addressed a group of besieged forces in the capital, Tehran. The leader said the main enemy confronting Iran is the global arrogance rather than ill-informed individuals or hired agents stirred up riots. Stirring up the riots, that is, Ayatollah Khamenei said the enemies are trying to spread lies and fake news and paint a dark picture of Iran. That's because, he added, they want to have dominance over the minds of the Iranian people. Also in his remarks, the leader rejected negotiations with the United States to resolve disputes. He said the talks will not solve any problems unless by paying ransom or crossing the red lines. Ayatollah Khamenei referred to the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution in 1979. He said the revolution tipped the balance against the favor of arrogant powers in West Asia, dealing a heavy blow to their colonialist policies. The leader added the creation of the usurper Israeli regime was in line with those policies to maintain dominance over the region. Turkey's president vows to establish a so-called safe zone in northern Syria amid the intensified Turkish attacks on Kurdish militants in the Arab country. Recep Tayyip Erdogan says Ankara will complete that zone as soon as possible. He has long sought to achieve this goal, which has been repeatedly decried by the Syrian government. His remarks came as a UK-based monitoring group affiliated to the Syrian opposition said Turkey carried out a new raids on the northeastern province of Hasaka earlier in the day. Turkey started hitting areas in northeastern Syria 2 years ago, but it intensified the strikes since last week when an explosion in Istanbul killed 6 people. Ankara blames the bombing on Kurdish militant groups based in Iraq and Syria, but they have denied the allegation. Damascus has called Turkey's airstrikes a breach of both international law and a serious sovereignty. Independent political analyst Mohammed Hassan Dabl says Turkey's attacks on Syria are a serious threat to peace and stability in the region.
This is really a serious concern for the region in terms of peace and stability. As you know, the ethnic spillover, the effect of this war will have, the consequences could not be imagined. It could lead to an all-out war. It could even involve Iran to take actions in support of the Syrians. They are taking advantage at the moment of the current situation where Russia, that had a lot of influence over in Syria, is at the moment involved in the Ukraine war, and Turkey is taking advantage of that, trying to expand its influence in the northern northern Syrian areas.
The Ukrainian president says over 6 million households in the country have been affected by power cuts amid Russia's missile onslaught. Volodymyr Zelensky says blackouts are continuing in the capital Kiev and most other regions, including Odessa, Lviv and Dnipro. He says, however, that the number of affected households has dropped by half since Wednesday. Russia has been targeting Ukraine's energy infrastructure in recent weeks. As winter approaches, this has stoked fears of a health crisis and a further exodus from the war-torn country. Moscow says it seeks to push Ukraine to negotiate, but Kiev says attacks on infrastructure are intended to harm civilians. That makes them a war crime. Our correspondent in Donetsk, Johnny Miller, gives details on how the critical situation in Ukraine, including massive blackouts, is affecting the lives of people there.
They're reaching chaotic levels now, the situation for Ukrainian people. Power out in large parts of the country, huge problems with water. The situation is critical, according to Ukrainian officials. And as you say, this may well cause another major refugee crisis into Western Europe. Russia trying to bring Ukraine to its knees, trying to bring it to the negotiating table by making it impossible for the Ukrainian government to look to provide even the most basic necessities to their people. And it could cause significant loss of life, particularly if it starts affecting hospitals. Now, will Ukraine be able to sustain these attacks on the energy infrastructure? The president's wife recently went on television saying that Ukrainians are willing and able to live without water and electricity for 2 to 3 years. She cited a survey which said 90% of respondents said so. It's also important to recognize that Ukraine has become an intensely repressive state. It's banned all independent media. It's banned most political parties. It has a very large and active intelligence agency, the SBU. It has far-right extremist military battalions that round up government critics, and particularly pro-Russian critics, and that often kills them. That's been well reported even by mainstream press now. So a combination of that kind of determination, genuine determination by Ukrainian people, and an intensely repressive state means that Ukraine may well be able to sustain these attacks on its infrastructure.
Rights groups accuse the European Union of breaking international law by attempting to prevent refugees from seeking asylum in the 27-nation bloc. It's also claimed EU leaders are discriminating against refugees if they do not originate from Ukraine. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Friday to discuss ways to address a growing refugee crisis. 281,000 people entered the EU seeking asylum in the 12 months to October this year, a 77% increase on the previous 12 months. But the ministers' meeting didn't appear to offer much hope.
We need to protect our external borders, and we need to return those who do not qualify for asylum and to be under the legal umbrella of the European Union.
Rights groups say this approach is scandalous, considering the EU was able to take in 4.3 million Ukrainian refugees within a few months. Regarding refugees coming from the Middle East and Africa, some member states are furious that other EU countries won't help with the numbers.
Unfortunately, the voluntary mechanism will only relocate less than 1% of total arrivals to the European, to the Med 5 countries this year.
One aid worker has told us he witnessed awful conditions for refugees on the Greek-Macedonian border.
I spoke to pregnant women who were sleeping on the floor. I spoke to Syrian young man who was trying to get to Europe to find protection with his disabled brother. Thinking of these people and what is being currently discussed, it's actually scary.
2,000 refugees died in the Mediterranean Sea this year as they tried to reach the EU. The bloc is paying billions of euro to countries like Turkey and Libya to prevent asylum seekers from coming here. Earlier this week in the European Parliament, the EU's broken asylum policy was castigated.
For the EU, all refugees except from Ukraine are illegal migrants, and yet most of them come from Afghanistan and Syria, countries that are victims of imperialist interventions and wars that the West caused.
It was suggested in the Parliament that EU authorities are racist, that Ukrainian refugees are welcome simply because of their skin colour. Rights groups are also condemning the racism and are asking EU leaders to remember the bloc's values they talk so much about. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Nurses in Britain are planning a strike for next month as their demands for a pay increase has been turned down by the government. The strike by the Royal College of Nursing Union would be the first in its 106-year history. Nurses from England, Wales and Northern Ireland will be walking out on December 15th and the 20th. They're demanding a pay rise that would help them through the cost of living crisis plaguing UK families. This is how British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak reacted to the demands of the healthcare workers.
What the unions are asking for, I think, is a 19% pay rise. And I think most people watching will recognise that that's obviously unaffordable. And that's why I'm pleased that the health secretary is sitting down, talking to the union, and hopefully we can find a way through this.
Sunak acknowledged the difficult situation that healthcare workers and everyone else in the UK are going through as a result of the unprecedented inflation. He stressed that his plans outlined last week will rein in soaring prices and calm the economy. The planned strikes by the nurses would be the latest in a series of walkouts by tens of thousands of other union workers in various sectors. They're struggling to get by as the UK grapples with a 40-year high inflation rate of 11.1%. Former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan is set to address thousands of his supporters during a rally held between the capital Islamabad and neighbouring Rawalpindi. This is Khan's first public appearance since being shot earlier this month in an assassination attempt. To get more on that, let's bring in our correspondent in Islamabad, Nazir Kazmi. Nazir, so we know that Khan accused the government of the assassination attempt and other senior authorities. And we also know that he sort of welcomed an investigation by the government to launch an investigation into that assassination attempt. What's his stance at the moment? What are we expecting to hear from him today?
Actually, we were expecting much more from Imran Khan a few days ago. But since the new army chief, the new change of command in Pakistan has taken place, the situation is quite different at the moment. However, still this long march have a value in Pakistan's political arena. Pakistan's Imran Khan is now trying to put pressure on the government, as well as he was trying to put pressure on the establishment to hold fresh elections in the country. Because when he was ousted in April through a parliamentary vote by the opposition, who is in the government now, it was Imran Khan was trying to put pressure on the government for new elections. What he believes that once he will be in power, he will try to resolve all issues, including the worst economical situation of the country at the moment. The political activists of Imran Khan's party, they are coming all across from Pakistan, especially PTI government has two governments in the province of Punjab and secondly in the province of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. So this rally is extremely important for Imran Khan's party because we saw that he came under assassination attempt in Punjab, and after that he paused, he halted his long march, and now he is resuming this long march again near Pakistani capital Islamabad. As far as Imran Khan's security is concerned, yes, extra troops have been deployed in all main key roads leading towards Islamabad, and a foolproof security arrangements have been made by the government, providing him the foolproof security. However, Pakistan's Interior Ministry still issued a threat warning that he could face again Rawalpindi. However, Khan is insisting that he will come, although he is injured, but he will come and face the people and he will speak to the people today. And as I told you earlier, that the activists of Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf party, they are coming from various cities and towns, and they are chanting slogans in favor of Imran Khan, and they are asking the government that the government should step down immediately and to hold fresh and free fair elections.
Okay, Nazir, thank you very much indeed for that. Nazir Kazmi, there, our correspondent, joining us live from Islamabad amid the bit of a political chaos there, crises in Pakistan. Now, moving on, the living conditions of Afghan people are worsening day by day. Many are struggling to make ends meet, while the Taliban rulers have been stymied in their attempts to repair the economy. Rahmatullah Baghban has more from the Afghan capital, Kabul.
A recent Afghanistan welfare monitoring survey by the World Bank is sounding the alarm bell about the devastating living conditions of Afghan people. People are struggling to put food on the table while lacking access to many other simple necessities. Almost half the population has reported a constant decrease in monthly earnings.
We are facing many difficulties, especially in recent weeks. We slid into a bad recession. I work from dawn to dark, selling potatoes and onions, but so far I haven't even made a penny to buy some loaves of bread for my 6 children. Our house is cold and I have not bought fuel. I am concerned about the health of my children.
The survey has also found a rise in unemployment rates across the country. More and more Afghans are finding it difficult to land a job. The situation is only expected to get worse during the coming winter months.
We are sitting here in front of this bakery because of poverty and unemployment. We are awaiting people to come here and buy us some loaves of bread. We leave our homes in the morning to look for jobs, but no one hires nowadays. It is becoming very difficult to make ends meet, especially in the wake of the cold season.
World Bank officials have called on Taliban rulers to take action on improving the living conditions of Afghan people. The Taliban says it does have plans, but needs access to the Afghan assets frozen by Washington in order to make them work.
With regards to addressing people's livelihoods and poverty, I confess there have been problems. And the major reason for the economic crisis and deprivation of Afghans is that their assets are crucially frozen. Furthermore, Afghanistan is practically sanctioned. Those who were defeated in Afghanistan use sanctions as tools for advancing their foreign diplomacy. But we are trying to neutralize the effects of sanctions and move Afghanistan to gradually become stable and self-sufficient.
The U.S. withdrew its forces from Afghanistan in 2021, but that has not stopped American politicians from asserting pressure on Afghan people. The war-torn country has not yet got the chance to repair the damage caused by more than two decades of Western aggression. As the winter comes closer, more and more Afghans are struggling. People here believe urgent support from the international community can be a lifeline for millions. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Current world order will be replaced by a new order where US is isolated, Asia powerful, resistance front expanded. This is the part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with students on Wednesday, November 2nd, 2022. This meeting was held on the occasion of National Students' Day and National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance, which are commemorated on the 13th of Aban, 4th of November. The Americans, their intention was not to leave Iraq. They then tried to appoint their own agents, but they failed completely. They failed in Iraq, they failed in Syria, and they failed in Lebanon. The recent agreement between Lebanon and the usurping regime, Israel, regarding the issue of maritime gas-filled borders and the like was a part of America's failure. This is because the Americans started ordering things. It must be done this way and that way. Hezbollah rejected all this. This is America's failure. It is obvious that their calculations are inaccurate. One of the things that I'm saying this now, some other people across the world have apparently said it too. I believe that one of the signs of America's decline is the election of people like the current and the former presidents.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Country of 300 million plus people almost destroys itself and elects a president in the previous term, somebody like Trump, whom the world considers to be crazy, and after he was defeated, a man like this current one comes to power. And well, you know the stories about him. This is the evidence of the decline of a nation. This is evidence of the decline of a civilization. So this was matters related to America. Many other Western powers are similar to the US in these aspects. Now, I don't want to name them, but some other Western powers are like America in this field. In the media, they teach destruction. They teach people how to riot and how to make Molotov cocktails and hand grenades. What is the reason for this? This issue is not that they are committing a crime by doing this. Yes, it is a crime, but it is also depravity. This is depraved behavior. Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The Democratic Republic of Congo is considered to be among the richest countries in the world in terms of natural resources. Now, its untapped deposits of raw materials are estimated to be worth in excess of $24 trillion. Despite this, the DRC has some of the poorest people in the world. Numerous reports indicate that global tech giants have been looting Congo's rare minerals. To add insult to injury, they are buying minerals extracted by children working in conditions similar to those of classic slavery. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. Today, we are focusing on how some of the biggest European and American tech companies are buying minerals extracted using child labor while financing wars in the Central Africa region, especially in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The second segment of our show is on the call by the South African president for an end to the sanctions imposed by Western powers on Zimbabwe. Will these Western neocolonial powers, especially Britain and the US, heed the call and stop punishing Zimbabweans? Stay with us as our experts give us their incisive analysis on today's subjects. You can also be part of the conversation by sending your comments through our social media handle.
Blood minerals for tech giants. A new report by the Global Witness states that much of the world's supply of coltan, tin, and tungsten minerals is extracted in the Democratic Republic of Congo using child and forced labor. The beneficiaries of these blood or conflict minerals are the world's biggest tech companies, including Alphabet, BMW, Apple, and Tesla.
A Congolese child miner who works in a cobalt mine says they get nothing from their hard work while global tech giants reap all the profits.
We're working very hard and digging very far to take this out, but we're getting almost nothing for it. The conditions are dangerous, but we're not paid for our level of sacrifice under the ground.
And to discuss how Western tech giants are using child labor to loot minerals from the Democratic Republic of Congo, we have contacted Ramiro Fernandez, activist and political commentator. Thanks a lot for your time, sir, today.
Thank you.
Now, the issue of blood minerals is not new. And despite earlier pledges to end exploitation of African children, the situation seems to be getting worse. What's the reason for this?
The reason for the exploitation of African children and the extraction of blood diamonds is the current Anglo-Zionist world order that created the diamond industry to begin with. Artificial, this synthetic creation of a demand for a rock, a piece of rock that has no value, created a whole market around the extraction of these rare minerals and these rare jewels that ultimately resulted in the loss of millions of lives of especially young children and young boys who actually are the ones who look for these rare jewels in the ground. And so the African people have been victim to Anglo-Zionist capitalism, imperialism, and colonization that has created a false demand for something that has no intrinsic value. So that is ultimately the root of this.
According to a new report, smelters and manufacturers that use coltan, tin, and tungsten in cars, mobile devices, and other electronics can't be sure the minerals have been extracted without using children or forced labor. The International Tin Supply Chain Initiative, which is supposed to guarantee responsible supply chains, has ignored or downplayed failures in the monitoring and chain of custody of mining in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Tech companies, mostly from Western countries, are ready to obtain blood or conflict minerals from Africa, even if that means walking on the skeletons of African children. Clearly, slavery is still being practiced by Western countries such as the US, France, and Britain that claim to champion for human rights. The Western powers are looking away amid this gross violation of the rights of African children by Western tech giants.
One of my favorite sayings about the great Satan, as the great Ayatollah Khomeini once said, describing the United States as the great Satan or the great deceiver, is that the great deceiver, the great Satan, always lies about what their true intent is. The US and the European powers go into continents like Africa, Asia, and Latin America with the claim of wanting to develop the area or promoting human rights or uplifting people, when in reality they are deceiving us. It is the complete opposite. They are in there with the sole intent of extracting minerals, raw materials, resources like cobalt like coltan and so many other minerals that are essential toward their technological development in the arms race of the Western powers, that they go in there with any excuse that they can, human rights, NGOs, democracy, and they take the opportunity to monopolize the industry, to extract as many resources and minerals as possible. And so anything that the U.S. and the European powers say that they're doing in Africa in terms of human rights and democracy, we just have to take it as a complete opposite, because they're deceiving us when it comes to their presence in Africa.
The European Union flag was recently set on fire in the city of Bukavu in the eastern DRC as hundreds of Congolese protested against the M23 rebels. Many people in the Congo believe Western powers such as the United States, Britain and France are backing the recent offensive by M23 rebels in the mineral-rich eastern part of the country with the sole aim of looting Congo's rare minerals.
The population living in the east of the DRC is the victim of multiple attacks by Rwanda and Uganda, with the blessing of the great powers, mainly the United States of America, Great Britain, France, and other countries. Let us express to the whole world our discontent with what we call injustice and international discrimination against the Congolese people that we are.
Now, is the upsurge in rebel attacks across eastern DRC linked to the looting of these countries' minerals by European and American tech giants?
The increased presence of fighting between groups in the Democratic Republic of the Congo and neighboring areas as well as the so-called South Sudan, which is an artificial nation created by the U.S. and also backed by Israel, there has been increased fighting between groups in this region because of the high demand for the rare earth minerals. The rare earth minerals that are in Central Africa can be found only in very, very few places around the world. Some of them also include Afghanistan. Some of them include North Korea, which are countries that the U.S. imperialists have tried very hard to control. The Central African republics, especially the DRC, there's a lot of value in that land because of the resources that are there and the scarcity that has been created.
The people of the Democratic Republic of Congo also believe the UN peacekeeping forces in the region are working at the behest of imperialist powers. Recently, Congolese civilians attacked a United Nations peacekeeping convoy, injuring several people. They accuse the UN mission of failing to protect them from worsening militia violence.
Our wish is for MONUSCO to leave our country because we can't see why they're here, what they've come to do here. Instead of our people benefiting from MONUSCO, we're being killed by them.
People in Africa have no expectation that Western powers will take real measures to stop the supply chain of conflict or blood minerals from Central Africa. African countries will only be able to maximize on their rare minerals through unity.
Now, as for the rare earth minerals like coltan and cobalt that are very important for infrastructure, technology, travel, microchips, and technology, another alternative to that is pulling together the resources of all of the countries in the world and figuring out alternative methods of doing so. There are different ways, different conductors, different materials we can use. It's just a matter of cooperation. And so I think cooperation among the nations on figuring out a new source of materials for this so that young African children don't have to die searching for these, but also shifting our values away from the decadent lifestyle of the West that values these rocks that have no intrinsic value.
The DRC is home to most of the world's reserves of cobalt and coltan, yet it's one of the poorest countries in the world. Now, these minerals are critical in most high-tech gadgets and equipment in the world. So what needs to be done to make sure that these natural resources in Africa are an opportunity for development instead of being a curse for the continent?
There's a huge contradiction in the resources that are available in the DRC and in Central Africa versus how these resources are distributed. It is a known fact that Central Africa is home to some of the most valuable resources on the planet, not just in terms of natural resources and precious stones and metals, but also in terms of vegetation, forests. The Congolese rainforest is one of the last in the world and is said to be one of the last rainforests that provides fresh air and water and oxygen to the world, the lungs of the African continent. And yet we have these leaders who are divided, who are subservient to the World Trade Organization, who are subservient to London and Wall Street and these international banking institutions. The only solution to this is to bring the power back to the people.
Well, there you have it. The Democratic Republic of Congo and indeed other African countries can learn a lot from Iran, a country that managed to kick out Western imperialist powers that were looting the country's resources. I would like to thank Ramiro Fernandez, activist and political commentator, for his insight today. We'll now take a short break before our next discussion on calls to end Western sanctions on Zimbabwe.
Western sanctions on Zimbabwe, creating wave of economic refugees.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
President of South Africa, Cyril Ramaphosa, has called for an end to the sanctions imposed by Western powers on Zimbabwe. He noted that the surge of economic refugees from the country fleeing hardship at home is putting a strain on Southern African nations. President Ramaphosa used the recent official visit to South Africa by the Spanish president to address the migration question plaguing the country.
The one issue that we have often raised, which is another dynamic in this whole situation, is that sanctions that have been applied to various countries, and especially on our continent, sanctions applied, for instance, to Zimbabwe, are having a negative impact, not only on Zimbabwe's economy, but also on a number of countries in SADC. They are also having a negative impact on us, because as the sanctions weaken the Zimbabwean economy, Zimbabweans then tend to migrate and leave and come to our own country and other countries in the sub-region. They flow to Botswana, they flow to South Africa, to Namibia, and then they exert enormous pressure on us.
Now, to discuss the issue of Western sanctions on Zimbabwe, we contacted Ian Richardson, an organizer with the All African People's Revolutionary Party. She's also the co-founder of the Thomas Sankara Center for African Liberation and Unity. Thanks a lot, madam, for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me back. I'm really happy to be here.
Now, what's your take on remarks by President Ramaphosa that Western sanctions are the source of economic hardships for the people of Zimbabwe?
I believe that these remarks are very accurate. I mean, if you consider the fact that Zimbabwe has been sanctioned for two decades now, and the economy of Zimbabwe has suffered ever since, I mean, I think that that's a very viable and valid statement. There's been a long concerted effort to portray Zimbabwean leadership as extremely incompetent, inept, unable to run a country, and responsible for the economic failings of the state, especially the Zimbabwean land reform policy, where land was redistributed from European settlers who colonized the country and whose ancestors violently stole that land to the indigenous peoples of Zimbabwe. That is often portrayed in this very racist way, this idea that the African people were so incompetent, they were terrible farmers, and that they sabotaged their own economy because they just have no idea how to work the land that their ancestors have been living on for thousands and thousands of years. That is the common portrayal of these and common justification for these sanctions that the United States and other Western powers put out. You know, my argument is that if that is the case, then why sanction the economy? If Zimbabwe's leadership is incompetent, if they're bound to just fail the economy anyways, why not lift the sanctions and then see how things play out?
The Western powers claim sanctions are targeting Zimbabwe officials, but clearly it's the people and neighboring countries that are suffering. There is no doubt that sanctions are actually intended to punish the people of Zimbabwe.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. And we know that wherever sanctions are issued, it's always working people, working families, rural farmers that are hit the hardest. We see this across the board. We see it in Cuba, in Venezuela, in Iran. Even the EU sanctions on Mali, the very brief ECOWAS sanctions in Mali, hit the country hard. So imagine the 2 decades that Zimbabwe has been through. I mean, it's the working people, the regular people, ordinary people who are suffering under these sanctions. And if you look at the grand scheme of Zimbabwe's history, I mean, you can just see how blatantly unjust it is. I mean, Zimbabwe was a settler colony that was under direct colonial rule since the 19th century, and just shortly after independence, I mean, just very briefly after independence, it's hit with 2 decades of sanctions from the most powerful countries on the planet. We're talking about a country that's been exploited for how long?
Alina Duhan, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights, last year called on the United States and other Western countries to lift their sanctions on Zimbabwe. She said the restrictive measures are making ordinary people suffer and are a violation of human rights.
I'm concerned that existing unilateral targeted sanctions as a punitive action violate, at the very least, obligations arising from universal and regional human rights instruments, many of which have a peremptory character. In particular, procedural guarantees and presumption of innocence, with a view that the grounds for their introductions do not constitute, for the most part, international crimes or comply with the grounds for universal criminal jurisdiction.
Western countries continue to arrogantly ignore calls by the UN to lift inhuman sanctions on Zimbabwe. Clearly, Western countries do not care about UN decisions.
Well, it's not really surprising to see, you know, a similar position taken in Zimbabwe, where the United States and other Western governments really don't care about UN decisions that are being made. I think, unfortunately, there's a huge level of hypocrisy. The United States promotes itself as the beacon of world democracy.
South African President Ramaphosa has reiterated that lifting the sanctions will lead to the prosperity of Zimbabwe, and the people in that country will be able to live normal lives in their country. Let's take a listen.
Zimbabweans who have left Zimbabwe will find great incentive to go back and to lead normal lives in their own country.
Now, do you agree with the sentiments expressed there by President Ramaphosa?
So I do agree with this statement in part. I believe that if the sanctions are lifted in Zimbabwe, Zimbabwe could have a much more prosperous economy once it has time to recover from all of the hardship that it suffered from. And many Zimbabweans may like to return to be closer to their families, to go back to their hometowns. That's very possible. However, I do also recognize that there are some tensions between South Africa and Zimbabwe and some pressure among certain sectors to maybe get Zimbabweans to go back to Zimbabwe under this premise that they don't have any place in South Africa. And so I'd like to state also very clearly that there are these colonial tensions rooted in colonial histories and colonial era divisions between South Africa and Zimbabwe and other states, but that cannot supersede the thousands and thousands of years of shared history between Zimbabwe and South Africa.
Well, it's not all gloomy. as Zimbabwe has stated that it is going to harvest about 400,000 tons of wheat this year despite sanctions.
The private sector players indeed supported over 33% to the total hectareage, that is of 79,000. So they supported almost 30,000 hectares of wheat this year. We believe that by crowding in, it's more sustainable to crowd in the participation of private sector rather than a situation whereby government will fund 100% of agriculture in an economy. It's not sustainable.
This is quite an achievement at this time when the world is facing a wheat shortage. Many believe Zimbabwe can resist sanctions in the long term by learning from countries such as Iran.
I believe that African countries should work closely with one another, and I think that they should also look to having international allies and partnerships with countries that have also been exploited or targeted in similar ways as these countries.
Last October, the chairperson of the African Union Commission, Moussa Faki Mahamat, once again renewed the long-standing AU demand for the immediate and unconditional lifting of sanctions imposed against institutions and individuals of the Republic of Zimbabwe.
Finally, can African countries such as South Africa unite and use their influence to pressurize Western powers to lift sanctions on Zimbabwe?
Absolutely. I mean, if African countries really make the effort to come together, I mean, I think this question of sanctions would be a non-issue, whether we're talking about in the Horn of Africa or in Zimbabwe or in Mali or elsewhere. We need to look more into our past, I believe. I mean, South Africa has given us wonderful models such as Robert Sobukwe and Steve Biko, who really emphasize the importance of African unity. Zimbabwe has as well. If you look at into Robert Mugabe, actually, he met his wife, Sally Mugabe, who is from Ghana, while he was studying in Kwame Nkrumah's Ghana during a time when Kwame Nkrumah was training African revolutionaries across the continent for the goal of a unified Africa. And so I believe we have to start looking more into this history and taking it more serious. I think we need to look back at some of these people in our history particularly and really study their political philosophy and take it more seriously, because I do believe that African unity is a viable solution to not just sanctions, but a whole host of problems across the African continent and the diaspora.
While indeed real unity among African countries can solve many challenges the continent is facing, including sanctions on Zimbabwe, I would like to thank our guest, Inem Richardson, for her incisive analysis today. That's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Khan of Islam page. Very welcome again to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host on this program. And with me in the studio, we have a very special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Nur Muhammadpour. Assalamu alaikum, Shaykh Nur Muhammadpour, and welcome to the program.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Okay, Shaykh, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the concept of gambling. Now, let's start with the definition of gambling according to Islam. What is gambling?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Gambling or qimar has two conditions in order for qimar to be, you know, stipulated. First of all, it should be by and via playing.
Yes.
Okay. And second, it should be kind of betting, you know, embedded in that.
Yes.
So if you miss these two conditions, at least, of course, the point and the verdict that I'm mentioning here is actually from Ayatollah Khamenei. But generally speaking, you know that the qimar, according to scholars, have some conditions. You know that this qimar, in order to be have this kind of, you know, gambling, we have to have this kind of betting, according to most of the scholars.
Yes.
And we thought that it is not gambling.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know that you can find different examples for that.
Yes.
And different forms for the, you know, gambling.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that this is a very brief definition of gambling.
That's all right. Okay, nowadays when you take a look, for example, at the world, playing cards is one of the most outstanding, we can say, tools of gambling, especially in casinos. For example, they go to the casinos, they have casino tokens or the chips, the plastic circles, which we can say they have value, monetary value. Okay, they are bought, they are played. And all in all, the main purpose of playing cards might be, or other tools of gambling, might be of winning or losing some money. Is it at all allowed according to Islam or not?
You know that if the these kind of betting, as I mentioned, is over there, they have betting between those people who have this playing. In that case, gambling, you know, is actually forbidden. But I need to emphasize that it has two conditions for that.
Okay.
And without that, we cannot say that, at least we cannot say that this is gambling. Maybe it has some other, you know, title which is forbidden, but without that, it is not gambling. But maybe other titles, for example, they cannot receive money by no effort has been done, which we call it aklul mal bil batil.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which means without for vain, for nothing, you receive some money. Because according to Islam, if you want to receive some money, you have to have some business or trade or some kind of, you know, different forms, which are legal one. And to have and to put some effort in order to receive some money, to have some kind of production over there.
That's right.
But for nothing and for vain, which is batil, you cannot receive money. And I think it is rationally acceptable, because when you do not have any production, when you do not have any usage for the society and for other fellow human being, how do you want to receive some money, you know, over there?
And if the money is not transacted, I mean, there is no financial, we can say, interest or income for that gambling, or for example, for that game, is it still allowed according to Islam or not? So, for example, if we play cards, or we can say a Muslim play cards without considering any financial interest.
Yeah, you mean that without any betting?
Yes.
You know, according to most of the scholars that I have checked, even playing with these gambling means, actually, gambling tools, actually.
Of course, we call it gambling. They call it game. game tools. Okay.
Is again forbidden because you know that in the verses of Noble Quran, Allah Subhanahu wa Taala talking about gambling. He said that يريد الشيطان أن يوغى بينكم العداوة والبغضاء في الخمر والميسر.
Yes.
Satan wanted to put enmity and hatred among you via wine and gambling. وَيَصُدَّكُمْ عَنْ ذِكْرِ اللَّهِ وَعَنِ الصَّلَاةِ and to prevent you from remembrance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and from praying. You see?
Yes.
Because of this philosophy that mentioned in the verse of Noble Quran, even playing with tools of gambling again is forbidden, even without betting, which we call it in Islamic laws,
yes,
playing with the tools of gambling, mm-hmm, okay? Even without betting.
Yes.
Actually, it is not gamble itself, because it lose the conditions of ghimar and gambling, but still playing with these tools is forbidden, at least according to the obligatory percussion.
That's right. Okay.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
You know what is important, even in the Western world, even in the non-Muslim lands, which is very much fond of gaming, gambling, you know, and playing, the case is that so many people are the victims nowadays of betting and gaming and gambling. They lose all their money in the gambling. They lose their family foundation, okay? So they are broken and they are bankrupt. And we can say they lose all the money that they have in these cases. And Islam has also warned the people about gambling and gaming and betting on different occasions, especially plays. Can you give us, an interpretation or better say explanation on the negative social effects of gambling, Sheikh?
You know that gambling has a lot of negative social effects on the society, mm-hmm, and on individuals. You see that, first of all, verse of Noble Quran talking about Maisir. Maisir is, you know, originated from the Yusr, yes, which means easily, without any effort has been put, you receive some money. And, you know, it is very destructive for the society. You see that it is very destructive for the society. It has no benefit for the society because there is no work has been done.
Yes.
There is no production has been done, okay, over there. And beside that, it causes a lot of hatred and animosity between people.
Mm-hmm.
When you lose your money, when you lose a lot of money in gambling, naturally it causes a lot of hatred within you.
Yes.
Okay? And it causes a lot of animosity between people.
Yes.
And I need to add to that, according to this verse, it prevents you from remembering of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and praying.
Yes.
You know, gambler does not go for praying or for remembering of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, trusting in Allah, producing some work and some kind of, you know, positive role in society. All of these because of gambling. And you know that the most benefit of that goes to those people who have this kind of,